From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we find out how private recordings of Prince playing the piano got released to the public today as a new album. Then director Tom Shadyac left Hollywood after making big comedies with the likes of Jim Carrey and Eddie Murphy. But his new movie about the true story of a man unjustly imprisoned is no joke.
It's important that the world laugh, and I value that. I think it's a sacred art. But there is more articulation to my spirit that wanted to happen.
And the codependent relationship between Spotify and the music business is getting tense. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair. Called inspirational and invigorating by the LA Times, the documentary follows 9 high school students on their journey to change the world through science. ScienceFairFilm.com. Science Fair, in theaters now.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We'll start today with Prince.
Never meant to cause you any sorrow. Never meant to cause you pain.
Fans of Prince woke up today to the first posthumous release of The Purple One. It's called Piano and a Microphone, 1983. The 9 tracks are basically just that, Prince playing around, singing some old and new tunes on the piano. But for a musician who prided himself on perfection, I wondered, what are the ethics of releasing these types of recordings if Prince, who died in 2016, never intended them to be made public? Gemma Aswad is Variety's senior music editor. When I reached him by phone, we began with what else might be in Prince's vault of unreleased recordings and videos, which was moved from his home in Minnesota to Los Angeles after his death.
Almost everything Prince recorded was at Paisley Park, his compound. I can't think of a better word for it, in outside Minneapolis. And after he died, the bank that runs his estate sent some people over to check out the condition of the vault, because obviously it's worth untold millions of dollars. And they found water damage and mildew. And it was determined, over the objections of a couple of his heirs, just to take it to a climate-controlled facility in Los Angeles. And it has since been cataloged as much as they can without listening to every single tape.
We should make clear here that Prince was meticulous, if not fanatical, about recording stuff. He might not have cataloged it well, but we're not talking about a couple of file boxes of material here. We're talking about thousands of entries and items and tapes and cassettes and God knows what else, right?
I mean, the mind reels at what must be in there, and I've spoken with the archivist, who can only say so much, obviously, but he says there are thousands and thousands of hours of recordings in there. There's concerts, there's rehearsals, there's things he was recording for other people, there's demos. They go all the way back to, and possibly before 1976, before he even had a record deal. So he was 17, 18 years old at the time, and he was recording all the time. Sheila E. told me that, like most days, they would rehearse for 11 or 12 hours if they weren't on tour.
So there are two things here. There is what's in the archive, and then there's the question of what to do with it. So who is deciding how this music is going to be shared? And even though Prince died without a will, do we know at all what he wanted to have happen to all of this material?
Well, to a certain extent, the estate is going against his wishes, right? Because he was most fanatical about owning the rights to his recordings. After he left Warner Brothers in 1996, every single deal he did was a one-off. He put out a record on almost every major label you can imagine. He put out a lot of independent releases. There was one year, I think he put out 4 or 5 albums. It was really crazy how much he was putting out. Now, there were certain great recordings of his that have never seen the light of day or have been taken or were taken out of print because he wasn't happy with the deals. You know, I mean, you still can't get, like, you know, the song The Most Beautiful Girl in the World, which was a huge hit, that is still not on the streaming services because of complications with the deals. You know, the Sign of the Times concert film, which is, in my opinion, one of the greatest concert films in history, you can't find it. Except, like, you know, on dodgy websites and, you know, janky DVDs. So to a degree, the estate is going against what he wanted and putting this stuff out to the delight of fans. Now, the way that it's working, There's an archivist, Michael Howe, who used to work at Warner Brothers. He was Prince's A&R person, or at least point of contact. He's the one who's like overseeing the cataloging. He's listening to a lot of stuff. He submits proposals for how to release things to the estate's musical advisor, who is a guy named Troy Carter, who used to manage Lady Gaga, who recently left Spotify. Troy and presumably Michael then take it to the six heirs, Prince's siblings and half-siblings, who have to give their approval, and then the recording is released either through Warner Brothers, which owns the rights to a lot of his earlier recordings, or Sony Music, which owns the rights to most of the rest of it, I believe.
So even if Prince might not have wanted this recording released, Piano and a Microphone, 1983, in your opinion, what does it provide us in terms of his music and an insight to his creative process?
Well, there's a couple ways to look at it, right? So a casual fan cues up this recording and thinks, hey, I'm getting ripped off. Purple Rain is only 90 seconds long. You know, he's just messing around on the piano. Well, yes, he is just messing around on the piano. He's practicing. But he's Prince. The piano playing on it is just incredible. He and actually Aretha Franklin are two of the most, I think, under-recognized great piano players, simply because they both did other things so well. So it's ironic in a way that someone who made such elaborate recordings, this is the first real posthumous release that comes out, because it is just him not really messing around, but practicing. Some of them are old. Two of those songs he had already recorded, Purple Rain and I think International Lover. There's a song that wouldn't come out for 3 or 4 years, which is Strange Relationship, which he recorded a couple of different ways before it finally came out on Sign of the Times. And the last two songs, there's no evidence he ever went back to them again. So it's a real look inside his creative process. You know, like at one point he's like sort of joking around and singing in what people call his Jamie Starr voice, which is this sort of like, you know, gangster, you know, cheesy kind of guy. Said that's the last night, baby. I've been at your house. People often said that music just flowed out of Prince. And I can't think of a better example of it than this. It's just him.
Jem Aswad is senior music editor at Variety. Jem, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you. It was fun. I never wanted no
woman. Piano and a Microphone is out now. Coming up, director Tom Shadyac returns to Hollywood a changed man 11 years after his last big movie was released. Oh, you know what I'm talking about, baby.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair, the number one audience award winner at Sundance and South by Southwest. Hailed by critics as inspirational and invigorating and supremely entertaining, the documentary follows 9 high school students from around the globe as they navigate rivalries, setbacks, and hormones on their journey to change the world through science. Visit sciencefairfilm.com for more information. Science Fair, in theaters now.
Tom Shadyac was once Hollywood's top comedy director. He made Ace Ventura and Liar Liar with Jim Carrey, The Nutty Professor with Eddie Murphy, and Robin Williams in Patch Adams. But in 2007, soon after the release of his last narrative film, Evan Almighty, the filmmaker had a bad bicycle crash that left him with post-concussion syndrome. He started to reevaluate his life and his priorities. He made a documentary, wrote a self-help book, sold almost all of his stuff, and left Hollywood for Memphis, where he's been volunteering and teaching. Last fall, I visited him in Tennessee because I'd heard he was back in the director's chair.
Ready, and action.
So what are my options here? Yes.
Shadyac's new movie is about the true story of Brian Banks, an All-American high school football player who was wrongly accused of rape and went to jail. Then his accuser, much later, retracted her statement. In that scene, Shadyac directed Greg Kinnear, who plays Banks' lawyer, Justin Brooks. Brooks is the director of the California Innocence Project and was on set the day I visited. Tom Shadyac asked him to speak to the cast and crew.
What this movie's about and why Tom was the perfect person to direct this
and everybody involved in this, and Monica and Amy up there, our producers, is because we care about making a film about the justice system that goes far beyond Brian, because there are many, many, many other Brians out there in prison right now who weren't lucky enough to have the miracle of someone coming forward and saying, hey, I lied.
How important is that to you to frame the day's work less about performance, but about its importance?
I don't view art in a compartment. Like, we don't just make movies about justice if we're unjust to people as we make movies. So I think everything has a holistic idea to me, and I want people in that room to understand Brian's story so they can roll forward the energy that is Brian, their desire to create a more just world. That room could be as important as any room that ever sees the movie. So I try to impart the scene and the tone of the scene and the reason we're doing the work to anybody who is going to enter this movie in a creative way.
Why was this the movie that you had to make at this time?
I've been trying to get a gig for about 10 years, and everybody said, thank you. And then there's this rumor that I retired, and it's not true. So being a creative person who wants to stay involved and active, I started teaching, and I've been teaching for 11 years, and that drew me to Memphis because I have family here. We helped to found St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, and I taught here, and I experienced the themes of these movies through the lives of my students. I saw kids arrested for being black. I saw the injustice that Brian experienced on maybe a more intense scale happen to my students, thrown in jail for crimes they didn't commit with no evidence and no resources to get the legal help that they needed to argue their case, to prove their innocence. And I could feel it in my heart. And when I read Brian's story, and as much or more when I met him, because Brian is the right microphone for this ideology, he went through an extraordinarily difficult shadow, but came out beaming like the sun. And I met him and knew that it was something that I wanted to be a part of, to try to bring this story to the world as emblematic of a larger issue in this country.
There are things that are parallel in my mind between what you went through and what Brian Banks went through, and I'm not going to compare them, but both of you had horrific things happen to you that were none of your own doings. Brian was unjustly accused of a crime he didn't commit and served multiple years in jail for that crime. You had a bike accident and suffered post-concussion syndrome. But both of you had what I will call an epiphany. You had a moment where you were able to kind of step outside of your lives and look at your lives in a new and different way and come out the other side with new direction, new focus, new perspective. Do you think that your lives, even though they're not identical, have some sort of mirrors in them, and that what happened to Brian spoke to you on a level beyond just filmmaker who sees a good story, that there was some connection beyond that?
Yes, I think there's a good, and I'm not likening what I've gone through to the deep pain that Brian's gone through, but yes, there's an absolute parallel, and not just with me and Brian, but you and Brian, and everyone and Brian. It is the hero's journey. We face obstacles. Brian's was an intense obstacle of losing 5-10 years of his life, a chance to play professional football, a chance to earn a living and help his mother, who had been working so hard for years. And he turned that darkness when he was unjustly accused of a crime, and he's turned it into light. And that's the opportunity that we all have. I had a concussion, and I faced my own death. And it helped me as I reinvented myself to drop fear in a more powerful way. The fear that said, these ideas that you've had, don't talk about them. That's why I made the movie I Am. This sense, this urgency that you have to make a difference, just push that aside and go out and make another comedy, which is important. It's important that the world laugh, and I value that. I think it's a sacred art. But there is more articulation to my spirit that wanted to happen. So, yeah, again, I think it's a story we all share, and I hope when people see this movie that it's certainly not a prison movie. It's a movie about what you do when the worst thing happens to you. And we're hoping that people will see Brian's story and say, you know what, if he can survive that and even thrive through that, then I can make it through my difficulty as well.
Why do you think people didn't want to hire you? When you say you've been looking for a gig and you couldn't get one, what did you hear? What did people tell you why they didn't want to put you on a movie or a TV show?
Well, they said no. they said, you know, I can't tell you how many jobs that I applied for where they just didn't hire me. So you'll have to ask them. I mean, a lot of friends said that's impossible. Your track record is pretty impeccable, and I have a strong track record. I've been blessed with a lot of what you'd call commercial success. I mean, on a subconscious level, I think in some ways maybe it's, you know, nobody's conscious about this, but subconsciously maybe I felt like I got sober and nobody wants the sober person in the opium den, you know? And so I sort of knew the day that I stopped flying privately because I didn't need to. Some celebrities do. I understand that, you know? I didn't need to, and there's a lot of resources that I could go ahead and give to people who needed them more. I sort of knew that day that I had left, you know, I had left the private club, and it was a matter of time before the private club didn't want me back in.
Because why? You were repudiating what they believed in? You were a traitor to the cause? I mean, again, imagining what it is that they imagined you had done, what was your betrayal?
Well, you have to ask people their own individual stories, and I don't want to, I love everybody in show business. I'm as imperfect as anybody in show business, but you know, we're all mirrors for each other, right? And maybe, you know, having me around wasn't a thing that they wanted to look at, you know? My cousin said to me once, oh, you fly privately. And I thought that was cool, right? I can get there quicker. I can have more time for business. But then he said, you know, you use more gas in one trip than a family of four does in a year. And I went, oh, that's not good. And so when I make those discoveries, I want to change. I want to do my best to reflect the beauty that I think we can all appreciate in this world.
I want to ask you this last question about values. This is something you write in Life's Operating Manual. I'm going to quote it now. No one worked harder than the caterers on Evan Almighty. They rose at 3 a.m. every morning to shop for us, cook for us, and feed us, but they were paid little in comparison to the stars, producers, and, well, me. The kitchen staff, I later found out, lived three or four to a room, as many could not afford a place to stay. But cooks are not paid handsomely, nor are ditch diggers or teachers or policemen or firefighters, because generally they don't grow businesses. Rather, our economy rewards the growers because growth, right up there with greed, is good. But is it? So you ask the question, what's your answer to that question?
I prefer it rhetorical at this moment. Well, it depends what you're growing. If you're growing more greed, I would say no, growth is not good. And I think we value every night on television this idolatry of magnitude. Oh, the stock market rose. Well, what does that mean? Oh, housing prices are up. Well, what does that mean for a person entering the housing market? Growth is not a value. Jesus and Gandhi and Martin Luther King didn't come and extol the virtues of growth. They extolled the virtues of love and compassion and kindness and generosity, mutuality and community. So if we're growing those things, yes, I would say this is tending us more toward more life, toward more community, to healthier communities. And if we're growing other things that are more about possessions and accumulation and being number one and standing on top while others are down below, a winner-loser model that doesn't work, then I want to push that aside in my own life. And see, this is what I think we've missed in art. We begin to accumulate, and I'm this guy too. I mean, I'm not pointing a finger at anybody. There's no fingers pointed out that aren't pointed in. And then we lock ourselves behind gates, right? And what turned us into artists, it's all the difficulties in our life are shut out now. We're behind gates and we atrophy. We atrophy as artists, but also as human beings. And I just think you got to keep diving in. It's not lean in, it's freaking dive in.
Tom Shadyac, great to see you.
Thank you, brother.
Tom Shadyac's new movie, Brian Banks, premieres tomorrow at the LA Film Festival. Coming up on The Frame, Spotify is trying to cut out the middleman and let artists upload their music directly to the streaming site. Should record labels be worried? Spotify announced this week that it's letting a select group of a couple hundred artists upload their music directly to its platform. And that could mean rising competition between the music streaming service and traditional record labels. The idea seems like a win-win for the indie artists who now have this direct uploading option. don't pay a label, and keep your freedom. And it also means a bigger slice of the pie for Spotify, which wouldn't have to share those artist revenues with labels as well. But does this really mean record labels should worry about Spotify cutting in on their business? Lucas Shaw covers entertainment and media for Bloomberg News. We connected with him at NPR West in Culver City to find out how Spotify may be changing the music landscape. And I started by asking him how Spotify chose the artist who can opt to upload their music directly to the company's platform.
The most important criteria is that they have control over their master recordings. So often when an artist will sign with a record label, now the record label is giving them promises of promotion, they're going to finance their recording, they're going to give them all the support, and in exchange, the record label then owns the copyright of the recording that they make while, you know, under the terms of that deal. But increasingly, artists are wanting to control their own copyright. And so those that do can just distribute directly on Spotify, because if they don't, they don't have the power to do with their music what they want. But if they do, they can make a deal with Spotify.
Music sales so far this year are up about 10% compared to a year ago. And you reported that 75% of those sales are from streaming. So if you're an indie artist, how much sense does it actually make to forgo a record label and upload directly to Spotify?
It depends on kind of how much confidence you have in yourself and the people around you to get attention for your work and distribute your work on your own. Because the reason traditionally to sign with a label has been all the different types of support they give you. Yes, there's the actual money just to record and subsist over a long period of time. But there's also a belief among a lot of artists that you need a record label if you want to get on Saturday Night Live. You might need a record label to help kind of push you, break you in other markets. You know, I was talking with somebody yesterday who noted that, you know, Migos, this rap group, had just broken out in Europe, and that only happened because of the work that, or the support that they had from a record label. But there are people and artists now and managers now who believe that the support of a label is less and less important, because with social media, with online services, with most of the music business now happening on the internet, and the internet being somewhat decentralized, they can do a lot of that legwork on their own. The question is, sort of, the devil is in the details. There's lots of royalty collection and things like that that happen outside the U.S. in particular, where artists may not realize how difficult that is to do on their own.
I want to play some music by an artist who is covered by this new Spotify initiative. Her name is No Name. She's from Chicago.
Your family looking like a prison. Mama at the table crying all her heck on. Feeling fishy, finding chemo, smoking seaweed for cone. These Disney movies too close. You title emo, No Name, thank you for your sweet.
Let's talk about No Name, hypothetically. The music business, like a lot of businesses, is very top-heavy. A small percentage of artists account for a huge percentage of sales. So if you're on a streaming service, how do you get traction if you don't have a record label pushing you? How do you get a profile so that people know to look for and listen to your music?
You work really hard to get placed on playlists. That's probably the easiest way. You know, Spotify and Apple Music and all the streaming services, they have dozens, hundreds, maybe even thousands now of different playlists. And what tends to happen is an artist will sort of percolate up. So they start on a lower level playlist that maybe they get on because they know somebody in the playlisting division. Maybe they get on because people are just talking a lot about them, or just by chance. And then as people stream more and more of that artist, they kind of rise up the ranks and eventually can get on one of the most popular playlists, like Today's Top Hits, which has something like 20 million followers. I believe it's Spotify's top playlist. That's one way. The other is sort of, you know, the old-fashioned who do you know and how do you take advantage of that. Spotify has certain executives who are in charge of these playlists, and you try to develop a relationship with them if you're an artist. Spotify, though, knows that it's going to be pretty impossible at scale to do this just based on human-to-human relationships, which is why they have started to create all these different tools so that artists can submit songs to playlists on their own, they can upload songs on their own. They're trying to democratize and decentralize the music business and make it so that there are fewer gatekeepers. Whether that can work is still a big question mark.
What is Spotify's long-term plan here? Because there has been some talk about whether or not it's actually going to start its own label. They leased a huge amount of real estate in LA in the Arts District. They posted a job for head of studio facilities. What do you think is really going on? What's their end game here?
Well, Spotify and the music business are locked in this codependent relationship, but they also don't trust one another. Because a gain for one can benefit both of them, but could also hurt both of them. So in Spotify's case, you know, they want the record labels to do well because that would mean they're doing well. But they also want to reduce the record label and other rights holders' share of their revenue, their profits, because they take such a large percentage of all the money that Spotify gets. So all these little initiatives that Spotify is rolling out, they are meant to little by little reduce what record labels take. So if right now labels take 70% of their sales, if they can get that down to 50, they have a much better chance of being a profitable business. And so they're trying, like many internet companies before them, to kind of take out all these intermediaries and establish what they would call a two-sided marketplace, where you have, on the one hand, you have artists pushing music through Spotify, and on the other hand, you have consumers listening on Spotify. Spotify becomes the intermediary controlling the demand and the distribution and taking out the record label, the music publisher, and all these other people from the process.
Lucas Shaw covers entertainment and media for Bloomberg. Lucas, always a pleasure to have you on. Have a great weekend.
You too.
And that is all we have for you this week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, and Jonathan Shiflett, with help this week from Audrey Ngo. Our intern is Maria Alexa Cavanaugh, and our engineer is Valentino Rivera. You can find The Frame as a podcast on Spotify, Stitcher, and Apple Podcasts. You can also read our stories on LAist.com. I'm John Horn. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll be back here on Monday.